It's not a construction project, so.
Well, it'll be some to get it running.
Yes, I agree. Agreed.
Sure.
But then we'd have the environmentalist mad at us.
The bill last time included a bunch of restrictions on like orchard pruning burns too. Yeah, I was kind of freaked out about that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
I like Mike. Yeah. Oh God, he's a kick. I mean, we're different on some issues.
We're going to open our public meeting here. The House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities
Natural
will please come to order.
The foundation for rural Oregon's prosperity. Without it, we'd die.
So today we have invited testimony and then public comment. We're going to do public comment after each of the two topics, not wait and do it all at the end, just so it's sort of relevant that they're gathered together. My friend the state forester therefore will be slightly delayed because there's definitely some folks who want to talk about the Elliott, I think, in the audience. And now, do you open a public hearing if there's no bill?
You just did it.
Yeah, that was it? Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Former Chair. So I don't know where my agenda is, but I know Louise is here to talk
there
to me.
You go.
Why don't you come on up? The director of the Department of State Lands. And then you brought with you, great, Nancy Hirsch, from Chief of the State Forest Division for the Department of Forestry.
Morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to come talk to you about the Elliott State Forest today. The Elliott State Forest is part of both the Department of State Lands and the Department of Forestry's real estate portfolios. It's an asset that we share. The State Land Board and the Department of State Land manages about 2.3 million acres of land and waterways across the state of Oregon, and those lands are divided into two parts. We have what we call constitutional lands or trust lands, which are lands that were granted to us at statehood for the purposes of generating revenue to finance public education. The Elliott State Forest is a part of that portion of our real estate portfolio, so it's a constitutional or a trust asset. And then we also have statutory lands, which are lands that were granted through legislative action for us to manage, and that includes most of the waterways that we manage around the state. The Elliott State Forest is made up of a little over 93,000 acres of land. We own 91% of it. The Department of Forestry owns the other 9%, so we are the major landholder in the Elliott State Forest. And it is, for the Department of State Lands, our largest revenue generator in the Common School Fund real estate portfolio. During the past year, off of all of our forest lands, we have gotten revenue from a low of about $8.5 million to in 2003 to a high of a little over $24 million in fiscal year 2000. The harvest levels, particularly in the Elliott State Forest, have been tempered in recent years as a result of ESA-listed, Endangered Species Act-listed species, including northern spotted owls and murrelets and coho salmon. And we also have other at-risk species in the forest. During this current biennium, we expect to get a little over $27 million from all of our forest lands. And when you look at those revenue numbers, the Elliott State Forest represents somewhere between, in a typical year, somewhere between 75 and 85% of the total revenues we get off of our forest lands. So it is the major revenue generator for the Common School Fund. We currently have in place a federally approved habitat conservation plan for spotted owls, which has been in place since 1995. We had a habitat conservation plan in place for marbled murrelets, which was only for 6 years, that expired in 2001. And the Department of Forestry has been working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service since then to develop a replacement HCP to cover not only murrelets but also coho salmon and other at-risk species.
Louise, I'm sorry, I just missed. You said since when?
Since 2001. Well, they actually started the discussions in 2000 because we knew the murrelet HCP was going to expire in 2001. So it's been we're in our ninth year of trying to get the new HCP in place. We anticipate currently off of the forest, we are harvesting about, well, between the two departments, we're harvesting about 25 million board feet a year, and we anticipate under the Habitat Conservation Plan that that harvest level will increase to about 40 million board feet, and we will be able to sustain that over the 50-year period of time that we expect the HCP to be in place. We're cautiously optimistic that we are going to have an HCP in place by the end of this year. We're sort of in the final throes, and I'm going to turn it over to Nancy, who's going to talk in a little more detail about the HCP process and where we are and what next steps are. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Klim, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch. I'm the chief of the State Forest Division with the Oregon Department of Forestry. And as we said, I'm really just going to touch briefly on our current management and provide a little more detail on our proposed planning effort for a new forest management plan and multi-species habitat conservation plan. Just want to provide a brief context to our current management. As Louise said, under the current forest management plan, harvest objectives are around 28 million board feet. Prior to this plan being approved in 1995, harvest levels in the mid or early to mid-90s had actually dropped to an average of around 18 million board feet, with a low as low as 5 million board feet. And as she mentioned, that was the result of the northern spotted owl and marbled murrelet listings. And so at the time in 1995, when the land board approved this current plan, they basically did this in that they felt it was a good business decision based on the fact that it actually increased harvest levels at that point in time by about 60% to the most recent levels in the early 90s. Since implementing the plan, we've been faced with a number of challenges in terms of meeting our outputs and accomplishments on the Elliott State Forest. Primarily, the fact that the incidental take permit for marbled murrelet expired. What that has created for us then is the fact that we now do take avoidance surveys to ensure compliance with the Endangered Species Act. As a result of these surveys, additional marbled murrelet habitat areas are identified, and when that happens, that continues to reduce the amount of harvest areas available for harvest. Another component of the plan that is also challenging is the current plan. Actually, about one half of the Elliott State Forest is constrained by what we call long rotation basins. So these basins need to achieve an age of about 160 to 240 years prior to us being able to go in and really operate in those basins.
Excuse me, what was the term again?
Long rotation basins.
And if I might, what
who sets up that constraint? What is that under the ESA? Is that
Chair Klim, members of the committee. That piece of the plan is a component of the current 1995 plan, and under this current plan, habitat is actually identified as a stand age, and that will in fact change under the new proposed plan. So we do expect that this new planning effort, the Forest Management Plan and the Revised Habitat Conservation Plan, will address and alleviate many of these issues. As Louise mentioned, the proposed plan would increase harvest levels to about 40 million board feet per year. This would be a 40% increase from current levels. Where we are at in that planning process with the services is that we're in the process right now of assisting the services in responding to comments from the first draft environmental impact statement. We expect a final draft to go public late this summer. The projected time frame then for a record of decision from the services is expected late this year, which would essentially mean that both the Board of Forestry and the State Land Board, if the record of decision is favorable, would be in a position to approve both the new Forest Management Plan and Revised Habitat Conservation Plan late this 2009, possibly in January, February 2010. The last point I want to make is, given the challenges that I mentioned that we're having under the current plan, and the fact that the duration of planning has taken longer than we expected, we do have some interim planning that we're doing right now to improve outputs on the Elliott in the next two planning years. So this relates to our annual operation plan period, which is a fiscal year 2010 and 2011, which will get us closer to the 40 million board feet. And what we're doing is focusing some operations in what we call mature stand thins. And these type of operations are consistent with the current HCP as well as the proposed Habitat Conservation Plan. So that's all I have for you. I'd be happy to address any questions you might have.
I know we're going to have questions, and so we'll do some, then public comment, then we may have you come back up to respond to things that come out of that, too. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, a couple of questions. Is your rotation age, what is it, or is it the same across the entire forest, or is part of it different?
Chair Klim, members of the committee, the rotation age varies depending on the basin on the Elliott. There's actually a number of different basins, and the rotation age is established for each one of those.
Give me an example of what they might be.
Rep. Krieger, one of the, as I mentioned, a majority of the forest is in these longer rotation basins, 160 to 240, but others are like at 80-year rotations.
Okay. One other question, Mr. Chair. What is the annual growth on that land?
Rep. Krieger, I'm not sure exactly on that, but I can get back to you with that.
Yeah, I'd like to know that, because I know it's considerably more than what you're cutting, so you're building volume, which means you're end up producing more habitat, which puts you in the business of providing habitat for owls and not following the constitutional requirement of that land as for the purpose of those lands. I'll make sure we have that on the public record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says here approximately one half of the Elliott Forest is constrained to long rotation basins, 160 to 240 years. So essentially they're just off limits. We're not going to do anything on them. Unless we really get some common sense in this state between now and then, my humble opinion. Now, you went from 5 million board feet at 28, I think you said, or 25, and the goal is 40 million. In 2005, Representative Krieger and I sat on the Ways and Means Sub on Natural Resources, and we heard reports, and I asked my friend here what that number was, that they could sustainably, with all the bells and whistles and protections in place, get up to 70 million. And I'm going off his memory, which is better than mine. Is there a component in this plan? Let's say you got it up to 40 million, and with all the measurements on habitat and populations of all these species, which, by the way, I support protecting. I want to make that clear on the record too. Let's say they're thriving, they're doing good, best case scenario. Is there a component in there that would allow us to increase that number, 40 million, if all that came to be? You following me on all that?
Yeah, Representative Schaffler, I believe your question is if opportunities are available under this new proposed plan, could we increase harvest levels above 40 million board
yes,
feet?
Ma'am.
My understanding of the current multi-species habitat conservation plan that we would have to average over the long term approximately 40 million board feet.
May I just follow up briefly? Yeah. So we're locked in at that number no matter what the science and habitat tell us about the populations of these species. Is that correct? Under the new proposed plan?
That would be correct.
Thank you.
Representative Van Orden.
Thank you, Chair Clem. What role does the market play in your decision on cutting?
Rep. Van Orden, members of the committee, right now in terms of our annual harvest objectives, basically as a department, we develop a plan to meet those annual objectives. We certainly have a portfolio, a range of mix in terms of timber types and ages that we end up selling in any one given year depending on the timber that's available. But we do try to achieve and accomplish those objectives. Obviously, right now with the economic situation the way it is, we're having conversations with the Department of State Lands in terms of whether or not we want to do anything differently.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wingarden, then we'll come back over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume that there are privately held timberlands in the vicinity of the Elliott State Forest. I was wondering if either of you two could enlighten me as to what kinds of harvests they're doing on those neighboring pieces of timberland versus what the state is accomplishing on the Elliott.
Rep. Wingarden, members of the committee, there are other private ownerships in relationship to the or adjacent to the Elliott State Forest. Typically, the industrial type landowners have a much younger rotation age on their lands, maybe as anywhere between 40 to 50 years of age. And, of course, the smaller landowners, their mission and objectives could vary very much.
Follow up,
Mr.
Chair. What I'd like you both to answer is the question, if this land were in private hands, would the harvest be higher, in your opinion?
Rep. Wingarden, members of the committee, probably take a couple, make a couple points related to that. First of all, I would say the objectives that we can and the management scenarios that can be applied on the Elliott State Forest are somewhat driven by the current condition. And so the Elliott, the land base itself, as we all know, is a much older forest than a lot of the lands that maybe are already in private ownership and being managed today. And so the information and what we know about the Elliott in terms of managing and ensuring compliance with the Endangered Species Act, we know and have a lot of data on current northern spotted owls as well as marbled murrelet. So that is a major factor in the management alternative that's being proposed. In terms of how a private entity would manage the Elliott State Forest, there was a study completed in, I believe it was 2004, called a cost-benefit analysis that was actually a part of a budget note from, I believe, the 2001-2003 session. And I want to reference that just briefly because what that study did was look at the market value for the Common School Forest Land portion, i.e. the Elliott State Forest, and they determined that the net present value at that point in time ranged between $265 million and $489 million. This is quite a wide range because of the uncertainty associated for anyone managing the Elliott related to these listed species. The current plan that we're proposing, net present value is proposed really at a range of 318 million board feet to 381, which is about the midpoint of this broader range that was studied and looked at in terms of if these lands were managed under a private entity.
I'm going to come back over here and then we'll come back. Representative Roble?
Yeah, and I have a couple questions as well. And I guess my biggest concern right now is that when I came here in 2005, and we had these conversations in Ag and Natural Resources, the understanding and the feeling was that by the end of that biennium, by the end, we would probably have our HCP pretty much in place, and that we would be coming back to look at that in the 07 session. And then in 07, the understanding was that we were working on it, and we were hopeful that maybe we could get it ready to go by the 09 session. And now we say it's about a year away. Do you have a lot of confidence in that year, or are we in the same kind of position that we've been in? That concerns me, because there seems to be, when we work with the federal government, something new that comes up and adds to the next deal, and we just continue to move this process a couple bienniums down the road.
Mr. Chair and Representative Roblin, I share that frustration. As you can imagine, we have been anxious to get this HCP in place and begin harvesting timber at levels that we think are sustainable given the ESA-listed species that we have in the forest. As I said earlier, I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to get there. Getting the draft environmental impact statement out on the streets for public comment, which was a major milestone in my mind. The services are currently reviewing those comments and will work with the Department of Forestry and the contractors who are working on the HCP for them to identify some changes that may need to be made between the draft and the final. And that, in fact, there's a meeting going on today with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to have that conversation with them. So we are, as I described it when we finally got the draft environmental impact statement on the streets, we're at the beginning of the end, finally. It took a long time getting here. A lot of it had to do with the services not having adequate staff to do the review work that we were asking them to do in a timely manner, so we got delayed several times because of that. I've been talking to both higher-level staff at the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, trying to get them to commit the staff time that we need this year to get this product done. Now, there's been a change in administration. We don't know how that's going to impact the process. It's a little disconcerting to us, and it creates some uncertainty. But, again, we're going to continue to press because it is very important. And although we have an interim strategy to increase thinning to get us up to that 40 million board feet for fiscal year 2010-2011, it's very important that we get this HCP in place so that we can begin full implementation in 2012.
Just a follow-up, kind of. It's actually two more little ones that are follow-ups. The one has to do with, you had the question regarding private forest lands. Have we done comparisons with Coos County, who abuts this on a number of places, and their harvest procedures with respect to the states? Because there we have two public entities. So if you don't have that, I would love to see the comparisons between Coos County forest lands that are harvested and the Elliott forest lands that are harvested. So I don't know if you have any answer to that right now. I wouldn't expect it.
Representative Chair Klim, members of the committee, I do not have that information, but I can follow up with you on that.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Roblin, I just follow up on that about what's going on in the surrounding forests, because we've sort of had that conversation with folks. I think it's important to point out that on the Elliott State Forest, we do have older forests, and it is very good habitat for spotted owls and marbled murrelets. And the habitat that surrounds us is younger age forest and would not normally attract those species. So we have this forest that provides high-quality habitat for some of these species that are listed. The surrounding forests do not have comparable habitat, and they are on shorter rotations. They have been in industrial commercial operations for decades, and so you're looking at a different kind of forest than the Elliott State Forest is.
Follow up on that one, though. On the across the Umpqua River, we also have the Siosla National Forest, and they also provide that habitat. One of the issues that I would contend is we have maintained our forest in better shape, even though they may be having a forest which is growing older. It is not in as good a shape, and I think that also adds to the reason that birds can fly through our forest. It's difficult to fly through some of the federal forests right now if you're a bird because of the stuff that's built up. So I would encourage, we shouldn't be taking they have a forest that's fairly large. They impose a lot of these restrictions. It would be nice if their forest could produce some of the habitat for the birds that they want. So since they already own 50% of our state, if there's one thing they should do, I would hope it would be to help the habitat of the species. And I guess secondarily, the last question I have right now, and I may have a few others, has to do with the state school fund. And the proceeds of this actually go there. Can you tell approximately of the principal that's in that account what percentage of that has come from the forest?
Mr. Chair and Representative Roblin, I can't do that. I don't know the number today, but we can attempt to do a calculation. It's important to remember that the Common School Fund has two pieces to it, the principal of the Common School Fund and the deposit liability right. account, which is all of the unclaimed property that has been submitted to the state of Oregon that has not been claimed by its rightful owner. And that number is that portion of the Common School Fund today that's the deposit liability is about $300 or $400 million. So it's a growing part of the Common School Fund compared to the principal. But we can take a look at over the years how much we'll see if we can.
Right, I mean, because I think it has been a major contributor, and I,
yes.
you know, and I guess the last thing that I want to say for this committee is that I worry, and I look at the lawsuits that have been filed in over the years about the constitutional purpose of these funds. And in the early 1900s, we had a number of political and other people make some choices with respect to state lands. We would have had a much larger forest today if things hadn't happened then. And it was a disaster. There's a great book about the people who went to prison for sales of some of these trust lands. So I appreciate that we have this trust lands. I think it's important. But the common belief and the reason those trust lands were there were to help provide, and it is my opinion that had they all of those lands been kept in and harvested appropriately across this state, not just the Elliott, we would have a lot of money in our common school fund today. So that's more of a comment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roblin, I couldn't agree more.
And I would like us to be using it in the best possible way.
So I'm going to come back. We've got a couple more questions, and I want to have the public folks talk, and then we'll have more questions, I'm certain. I'm planning on going until at least 9 on this topic alone. Representative Winkler, did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard you mention twice that the Elliott has stands that are older. I guess my question is once they burn, will you be able to recategorize them and maybe begin to harvest them at levels that our neighboring county lands and private forest lands are doing this because they won't be old anymore?
Chair Klim, Rep. Wingard, members of the committee, I think your question was if they burn.
I should have said when, but yeah, okay. I did say
said when.
Yes, I would. I'm pretty confident that both the Forest Management Plan document as well as a Habitat Conservation Plan have options or clauses in them in the event there is a catastrophic event, fire, insect, and disease, that appropriate alternatives could be sought in order to ensure a healthy forest over the long term. And just to note, that's an interesting point in terms of the fire because it's really the result of the fire that the forest is of this older age all at one time.
I just wanted to make one last comment, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to piggyback on what Representative Roblin was saying. These lands are constitutionally required to produce money for our public school children. And I am convinced that it is the State Land Board's fiduciary responsibility to get the highest return possible from these lands on behalf of kids. These are not the same lands as, say, the National Forests and some other lands which have other broader purposes set out for them. And I am also convinced that we are not meeting that current responsibility to get the highest return possible from these lands on behalf of our kids. And I can't think of a better time to be having that discussion than when we're facing the budget problems that we are. Layer on top of that, that to actually increase harvests would put some people to work in this state in our natural resource sectors. And there are many counties that are already at 15% or close to 15% unemployment, and with the briefing that I got yesterday, likely headed to 20% unemployment. And I can't think of a better win-win scenario than to produce more money for our public schools and to put people in rural Oregon back to work. Thank you for letting me get on my soapbox, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger, did you want to
just briefly, Oregon's lost its infrastructure to handle and mill older or larger logs. And if you're waiting, as you said, up to 240 years, we can't tell what's going to be available then. But those type of logs today, can you tell us the value that you're getting off those type of large timber today compared to the smaller timber where the technology is, they're doing very well on the recovery, and how many mills you actually have bidding on that timber because of the lack of capacity to mill those large logs? And does that mean also are we having to haul it longer distances, which eats up a lot of the value?
Chair Klim, Rep. Krager, members of the committee, I can answer some of those questions and follow up on the ones that I don't. The first one, the larger diameter wood on the Elliott actually is still, we're still getting a premium price. Overall, the stumpage prices there on the Elliott are the best that we have in the state. The specifics on that I can follow up with you, but I'm pretty certain that we're still receiving $400 to $450 a thousand on those larger diameter wood. That said, there still is, not given the current economic conditions, as good as price on the smaller diameter, but there is a standard 2x4 type log that does usually return a good value. And the number of your last question, I think, was a number of purchasers bidding on this larger wood, and I don't have that with me, but I can follow up with you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so at this point, I'm going to hear from our folks on our sign-up sheet. If you please stick around, I'm sure we'll have some more conversation and questions. And first is Ralph Saperstein. Okay, well, we'll come back to him. John Charles with the Cascade Policy Institute.
Shirt you've got on.
I'm trying to make spring come early. Ralph, we'll get to you next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, which is a nonpartisan research center based in Portland. My comments today, I'd like to put in a little bit of a historic perspective, because the issues that you've raised here are not new. They don't pertain just to the current management team of DSL or the land board. They go back at least three decades. I first got interested in this when I randomly received in the mail the 1995 asset management plan. It was a draft offer of public comment. And in it, the authors proposed that since the rate of return on all of the common school trust lands had been diminishing for a long time, one possibility would be to sell them and put all the proceeds into the common school fund, where the Oregon Investment Council was routinely having returns greater than 10%, sometimes greater than 20% per year, which was far in excess of what we were getting from any of the forest lands or our range lands, which were actually losing money. And so the problem with this is, I mean, just fundamentally, there is, of course, this constitutional requirement to maximize revenue. We have not been doing that. That's not the primary objective anymore. And that trend was noted in the 1995 plan, which said, okay, now this is 15 years ago, this is being written, quote, over the past 20 years, the Common School Fund's financial investments of cash, equities, and bonds have consistently obtained above market rates of return. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for the financial performance of the real property portion of the Common School Fund portfolio. Overall, these assets have been consistently underperforming in terms of contributions to the CSF, particularly in comparison to the returns obtained by the state treasurer's investment pool. Well, the LSA Forest is the most valuable asset, and it in particular has taken the hit. As again noted in 1995, quote, largely due to the costs associated with protecting endangered species, expenditures incurred by DOF in management of the common school forest lands have increased significantly over the past 9 years, reducing net revenues to the CSF. This trend is expected to continue. Well, as indicated in the attached spreadsheet, the trend has continued. Management the common school fund in recent years has more than doubled over the past decade. For the Elliott alone, total cost of management was 48% of revenue in 2008. Now, it seems to me the legislature continues to hope that every 2 years, whoever is managing DSL and DOF can be brought over here for this conversation, and after a certain amount of hand-wringing, things will get better. And that was certainly the message 2 years ago when this was discussed. And DSL at the time speculated that rent and revenues would soon be going up, and predictably that forecast proved wrong. At the April 2008 land meeting, State Forester Marvin Brown told the board, quote, in July 2007, we were thinking net revenues for the biennium would be $29 million. Instead, it's going to be $23, $24 million. DOF informed the State Land Board that management costs would be going up, again, due to Endangered Species Act compliance. State Treasurer Randall Edwards commented, quote, you, DOF, can seem to harvest more and your costs are going up, and hopefully we don't have a convergence of those lines. But my concern has been that that's been a trend going the wrong way. Now, when the subject was revisited as recently as October of 08, State Forester told the board net revenue to the Common School Fund last year was down 36%. It was only $4.6 million for 2008, close to the lowest level in 10 years. From 1999 to 2007, management costs in the Elliott averaged 31% of revenues, and this biennium will be about 35%. That's not tracking in the direction we want it to go, but I think that's a lot of indications here that it's going to get better. Well, I think this is sort of like the Chicago Cubs in spring training when everybody thinks that this is the year we can finally turn it around. And it's not a comment, a personal comment on who's running the show over there. It's an institutional problem. There's a 35-year track record here of hoping this is going to change, going back, in fact, prior to ESA litigation. And I think the model of public ownership here is doomed to fail. Now, this has been known a long time. 1994, DOF engaged a highly regarded forestry consultant, John Buter, who looked at this and concluded simply, selling the Elliott is the only marketing alternative likely to significantly increase net annual income to the Common School Fund, because we already know that taking that money, putting it in the Common School Fund, and managing it as the Oregon Investment Council does, consistently gets far greater return. Now, unfortunately, that recommendation has been ignored, but if it had been followed in 1995, the Common School Fund would probably have about $3 billion today instead of about $1 billion. And I recognize that by legislative standards, you know, in Congress, it's not real money unless it's a trillion anymore. But it seems to me, in the context of school finance, if you have $2 billion of lost asset value, I think that's something to be concerned about. And my final comment, I guess, is that in a prior life, I ran the Oregon Environmental Council for 17 years, so I know something about environmental litigation. And all I can say is the hope that if we just get past this HCP and if we just protect some bird habitat here or there, we'll get over this hump. For the people engaged in environmental litigation, public ownership in particular, suing and winning is like shooting fish in a barrel, or in their case, feeding fish in a barrel, I guess. This isn't going to go away. It's always going to get more complicated. The public sector will never manage lands in a way that the private sector does. And I think you'll just have the same conversation every 2 years. Now, you don't have the authority that I know of to force the sale of the Elliott, but we do have a new state treasurer, and I think you might want to ratchet up the conversation by inviting him over to discuss whether they would contemplate selling, given the litigation likely to come under ESA for as long as you can forecast. You might also invite some of the private landowners and actually other publics who have land near the Elliott and ask them, how is it that they manage to do better in harvesting while still complying with ESA? I mean, those would be enlightening conversations. And then if you don't get satisfaction, then you might contemplate what is it you could do to change things. But I think the only way you're going to get returns similar to the returns we get of in the common school fund itself is to actually sell these lands, put the money in the common school fund, and let the Oregon Investment Council do what it does very well, manage those for maximum revenue to common schools. Thank you.
So, quick question. Last paragraph regarding value of the common school fund today, if it had been sold in 1995, it looks like it's about $2 billion lower than it would be according to this estimate. So is that the sale price of the eld at that time rolled forward with, you know, interest, basically?
Mr. Chairman, yes, at the time, the common school fund, its investments of stocks and bonds was, I think, a little over $200 million, but the Elliott in 94-95 was estimated to be worth about $800 million on the private market. If it had been sold and that money put in, given that all through the 90s, the common school fund was having killer returns, well, you know, when you're starting from a bigger base, it's worth a lot more 15 years later.
Do you have any sense of what the net value is today? I will ask those folks too, but do you have any, I mean, is it a billion now?
Mr. Chairman, it's entirely a function of what people who manage it think they can get out of it while still complying with law. When the consultant's report was done, I think pursuant to the legislature ordering this in 03 or 04, they had this wide range. It could be worth anywhere from 300 and something to 700 and something. And it all depends on what you think you can do and comply. But in my talking with private industry consultants and people who actually own land, as recently as last week, the estimate I got was that if it was up for bid today, even with the current litigious environment, there are people who would bid between 0.9 and $1.1 billion. But as in the case of auctioning anything, whether it's, you know, a home run ball hit by Barry Bonds that sells for an obscene amount of money or anything, you never know what the market will bear until you actually allow the market to work.
Great. Any questions?
Yep, sure.
Yeah.
Briefly,
yeah. Schaffler.
You know, once again, I'm relying on my friend's memory, but it was clear to me, we've heard this testimony before in 2005 in the subcommittee. You know, and these folks from these departments are given directions, so I'm not going to beat up on them. They are given directions by other higher-ups, if you will. But I got to tell you, Louise, you talked about people coming to retrieve the property that's rightfully theirs. This whole process is about obstruction, delay, and denial. That's what it is. And the rightful owners of this property are being denied access to it, in my humble opinion. And another point I'd like to make is, where are my public employee unions? I want to ask that question on where's the Oregon Education Association? Why aren't they here today? It really frustrates me to no end, because this is a direct result on their ability to fund education. 90% of it goes to Common School Fund. All education advocates, where are they? Are there any in the room? No. That disappoints me. But anyway, forgive me, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, over the last 15 years that I've been interested in this, I've had a number of conversations with OEA, with COSA, with others. I am as baffled as you are as to why a billion-dollar asset does not interest them.
Okay. We're going to get our next. We have two more to go, and then we'll probably have some response from the agency. Oh, that's right. Four more to go. Excuse me. I forgot we had two on the phone. Do we have to call them?
Yes.
Are they actually on? Okay, Ralph, I'm sorry. All right, I'll have to speed it up. I forgot we had two. We have to call in to take their testimony.
I would have called in if I knew that was available.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Ralph Saperstein. I'm here today representing Boise Cascade, Associated Oregon Loggers, and Douglas Timber Operators, a group in Southern Oregon, right adjacent to the Elliott State Forest. And it was fortunate that when you called me, I had stepped out in the hall, because after Mr. Charles, what I'm going to say is going to be sound very reasonable, because I'm not going to advocate selling the Elliott State Forest. You all have asked some very good and pertinent questions, and I'm not going to repeat those. I think the important thing from our perspective is that when the Department of Forestry decided 9 years ago to update their habitat conservation plan, that really began an interminable process that we think has no end and will not result in an increase in timber sales from the Elliott State Forest. As you folks have mentioned, the private landowners adjacent to the Elliott have not tried to undertake a multi-species habitat conservation plan, and it's just inconceivable to us to think that the federal government, represented by NOAA Fisheries and the Department of Commerce and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in the Department of Interior, is that right, Chris? I hope it's Interior. Would allow a habitat conservation plan with an increase in harvests. And I guess under the Bush administration, the effort was hopeful that it would result in an increase in harvest. Well, President Obama has replaced the regional administrator for the Pacific Northwest for NOAA Fisheries, and so there's a new sheriff in town, and it's just highly unlikely that multi-species HCP is going to be approved by the federal government that's going to allow the Elliott to increase their timber harvest level to 40 million, which we think is way low to begin with. As we heard about the growth and the annual, the maximum sustained yield is somewhere between 60 and 70 million that could legally be harvested. In fact, back in the old days when I worked on the Elliott State Forest, we sold approximately 52 million board feet per year. My point is the habitat conservation plan route will not be successful. It's taken 9 years. It's unlikely to result in a higher allowable harvest for the Elliott. And my wife tells me all the time, I can't say this, but we will be saying, as we've been saying all along, we told you so. But that doesn't get us any more timber. And we think if you sent a message to the land board to look at a different strategy, because it's false thinking to think that that an HCP is the only way to comply with the Endangered Species Act. Forest landowners operate throughout the spotted owl region without habitat conservation plans, and they haven't been sued, they're not in jail. There's no reason why the Elliott can't operate in the same manner.
I know that's the topic of our next person, too, so we'll take a few questions and then we're going to hear. Yes, Representative
Mr. Peter. Chair, Ralph, can you tell us, so everybody understands, the kind of the difference between take avoidance and habitat conservation plan?
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert on habitat conservation plan, but I think what the state official would tell you is that with a habitat conservation plan, the federal services give an incidental take permit, which allows you to operate under that plan. In the take avoidance strategy Representative Krieger mentioned, the idea is just that, to avoid taking a listed species. And there's lots of strategies to avoid that. But the important thing to note that in our whole history with the spotted owl and the marbled murrelet, no federal court has ever found any landowner or logger guilty of taking a listed species. So we must be successful in avoiding take. The point is, we don't have to give away the store to comply with the Endangered Species Act. There are other options.
Great. Thank you very much. Bill Cluding. I know he's going to talk to us more about the same topic, the take avoidance issue from my earlier conversations. And then we have a couple of folks on the phone we'll handle after questions here.
Thank you, Chair Clem, committee. For the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. I'll skip a lot of my points I've had wrote down because most of them have come out. But when I appreciate Representative Schaffner's statement about where are the schools.
Where are they?
This has been to court many times. And every time, the maximum yield for schools is 1. The last time was the state of Washington. The Washington School Associations took the land board to court, and they won. It was approved here in this. You know, this goes back to 1859. The Constitution in 1859 said maximum net income using sound management. On the record, I want to state that this process that we're going through has made our Department of Forestry look bad. But for the record, I want to tell you, they have done a good job. The Oregon Forest Practices Act was the best in the world. So again, for the record, let me tell you, the Department of Forestry has done their job. What happened, it's like there's a knock on your door, and you open it up, and here's a long-lost relative, and you visit a little bit, and he says, "Hey, can I spend a couple nights and get my feet on the ground?" Well, 10 years later, you still can't get rid of him. And this is what's happened. I'm glad the take avoidance came up. You realize if the HCP is adopted, automatically another 25,000 acres has severe restrictions put on it. And when I say severe, I mean severe. And I've been asked why the environmental groups haven't been filing suit, and I want this to go on record. They haven't had to file suit because we haven't done anything in the Elliott. The work's been done for them. What's wrong with the Oregon Forest Practices Act? On a personal note, I have over 2,000 members in this area. Some of them are on layoff. In fact, I just helped a mill shut down a month ago. Right now, the market's bad. These people are on layoff, right about 250. But, you know, our industry's been like this since day one. It's up and down. We used to be big enough, we could drag the state right back up out of the hole and put the state back on their feet. We're still a big-time player. But when the market is good, this is really what irritates me. Train loads of logs coming out of Canada, out of Washington, all the way down through Oregon, to make sure our mills that are left run full-time. 44% of our lumber has a nail drove in it. Finished lumber comes from out of state. Those lumber trucks driving right through the towns where our mills are closed. Now, something's wrong with this. If we owned that forest and we followed the Oregon Forest Practices Act, we could take 60 million feet plus every year out of that and never hurt it a bit. I urge you to contact Coos County and find out what their forest does. I urge you. I know, but I'd like to hear them tell you personally. You know what 1 million board feet of harvest does? It creates 10 to 13 jobs. We could put 150 people back to work if we could get that cut back up. Now, right now, yes, the market is bad. But again, we go from 350 to 600, 650. In the long run, it averages out. And I've been using the figure. I first started on this when Senator Berger stood on the Senate floor begging for help from the Elliott Forest. Now, this was years ago. And I had a long talk with her. And I've had many talks with her since. And nothing has been done. Looking back, I think if I'd have worked harder in 2003, 5, and 7, maybe we wouldn't be here today. It's not too late to scrap the federal plan. It's not too late. Right now, the schools are crying for money. Everybody's crying for money. I've already made statements where whenever we start doing the cutting, we can't take away money from the elderly. This shortfall in the K through 12 funds, and I've used a maximum top figure. I've used, through this lack of activity in this forest, I've used a figure, we're short $100 million. That's the high side. There's no possible excuse for this. Right now, you've got to fight on your hands for another cause. There is no reason why any parent in this state has to pay money separately to send their kid to kindergarten. But yet, here we fight over money for schools. I'll talk to anybody. I urge you to go back to your caucuses. I urge you to go to the Senate side and talk with them. We can stop this. We can turn this around. We got Oregon's future to look at. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Just going to move us along here so we can get our other two in.
Thank you, sir.
Great, thanks. Okay, maybe down 9 first.
Thank you. Oh, that's only yesterday. I wish I would have had this meeting yesterday.
Members of the public.
Hello?
Hi, is this Francis Etherington? Hello?
I'll be at a bad reception place because I don't hear anything.
I told you never to call me. You're not muted. Can you hear me now, Mrs. Etherington?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Great. This is Brian Clem, Chair of the House Ag Natural Resources Community, the Rural Communities Committee. We're in a public hearing on the Elliott State Forest. We understand you wanted to make a comment.
Well, you know, I did, but I could do it last week, but I couldn't do it today because I'm out in the field today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. You're welcome to send something in writing if you like.
Now, so you're going to be talking about the Elliott later on today?
No, we're in the middle of a hearing right now. There's a whole room full of people listening to you, just so you know. And
Okay, well, I have something to say then. If you can hear me, I'll say something real quick here.
All right, that's what
I'm not exactly sure what you're going to talk about the Elliott, but, you know, it's a hard times to try and log enough to support the school system off the Elliott State Forest, especially since the Elliott State Forest is one of your most wildlife-friendly, one of your most ecologically important state forests. You know, over half of it has never been logged before, unlike the Tillamook and Clatsop Forest. It is so important to, especially to Marble Merlets, at being right on the coast and having so many mature forests. So we're really disappointed that the new HCP tries to increase logging by 40%, especially at a time when the Merlet and the Spotted Owl are facing really hard times. And you would have to increase logging tremendously to meet even what you did last year as far as finances when you log, because the price of logs is on the floor. So I think that you should reconsider actually trying to squeeze blood out of the Elliott to pay for public schools. You know, our education is too important for children to depend on logging native forests so important to wildlife.
Thanks. Francis, could you state your name and address once for our records?
Sure. It's Francis Etherington, E-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-G-T-O-N, and my address is 886 Raven Lane, Roseburg, Oregon.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, thanks for calling me.
You bet. Good luck today.
Okay, bye. Good morning.
Hi there. I'm trying to reach Day Owen.
Yes, just one moment, please.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Day. This is Brian Clem. I'm chairing the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. We're in a public hearing right at the moment with a bunch of people here. You're next on our list to call and take comment on the Elliott State Forest.
Okay. Should I go ahead and begin?
Yeah, just please identify yourself and address for the record, and then go ahead.
Well, my name is Day Owen. I'm the founder of Pesticide Poisoning Victims United. We're a division of what's called the Pitchfork Rebellion out here by Triangle Lake, Oregon. We're in timber country, and so our concern relates to timber out here in the rural area. We got our name rural right in your guys' name there, and we want to remind you that it's not only the big farmers that are rural, but there's a lot of folks like us living out where the timber practices happen, and we suffer a lot of consequences, and we'd like to bring that to your attention. Three members of my family have incurred medical bills after being exposed to herbicides applied by timber industry helicopters on the clear-cut hillside across from our home. Many of our neighbors and friends have also been poisoned, so we have organized in order to protect our rights, and frankly, we want to see some laws changed. Number one, we want a quarter-mile buffer zone on aerial spraying near homes and schools. You'd still be able to do ground application of pesticides within that quarter-mile buffer zone. This would strictly be aerial spray buffer zone. Today, we want to deliver a message to Oregonians for Food and Shelter and the agriculture lobby, and that is that if our dialogue with politicians doesn't result in our getting a buffer zone, and so far it's looking like it's not going to. We haven't had much luck getting in your guys' office and, you know, even pressing our case. So what we want to say is we're going to make a last attempt here to do this through the political process, but if that doesn't work, then we're going to go to the initiative process. We've received a lot of front page news coverage lately. Our organization has grown to be probably one of the largest grassroots political organizations in Oregon, organized about anything. We have people in every rural forested area in the state of Oregon in our membership. And because of the media attention that we've attracted even some like music celebrities and people who have offered to provide funding for signature gathering, putting it on the initiative. So what we want to say now, and we'd like you guys to communicate for us to people like Oregonians for Food and Shelter and lobbyists such as that, that the advantage to them in working with us now for a quarter-mile buffer zone through you guys is that if we don't get that, if we have to go to the initiative, that's so much more work on our part that we're going to be asking for a one-mile buffer zone. So it's actually to the advantage of Terry and the people from Oregonians for Food and Shelter to work with us now, do a quarter-mile buffer zone that permits ground application within the buffer zone, because if we have to go the initiative process, we're going to be asking for a one-mile buffer zone, and there's going to be other things that can't happen within that 1 mile. So what we're just asking today is for an initial, can we begin a conversation with you guys about having a quarter mile buffer zone? What we'd like to see is you guys have a special session for public testimony on that topic. And what we would do is we would bring in a lot of people who have had children rushed to the hospital. We have one family near us that said, three children rushed to the hospital. We have dozens of people who have had to seek medical intervention after aerial spraying.
Hey, Dave. Sorry to interrupt. The only issue is there will be a bill on that topic, so there will be, I'm quite certain, an opportunity for public testimony. Some of the folks you wanted to get your message to are here, and so they heard you. But we are trying to just limit our testimony to the Elliott State Forest because we will have other sessions on that topic. So are you saying that this is a publicly owned piece of property here, the Elliott? Are you worried about their use of pesticides, or are you really talking about other properties not in the Elliott?
Well, I have made clear to whoever the assistant-type person who set up this phone call for me yesterday that I would not be speaking about the Elliott Forest. That assistant assured me that during the public testimony portion of your meeting that a public person can bring up any topic they want. So I'm not linking this to Elliott State Forest.
Gotcha. Okay, well, the folks that you're interested in, one of them at least, is here. I'll personally relay the message to the rest of them for you, and then we can see you in person, it sounds like, on hearings regarding use of pesticides around schools.
Yeah, and if there are such hearings, is there any way that your office assistant could let me know?
I'll talk to Senator Bonamici, and one of us will.
Okay. Well, then thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Okay, Dave. Bye now.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I got to say it. It just shows how far unattached and unaware and uneducated some people can be on a subject. Think they're going to threaten legislators, if you don't do this, I'm going to do that. I'm challenging him, half right at it, because I will put $1,000 of my own money in the petition against his.
Okay, back to the Elliott.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry about that.
On the Elliott, please. Yes. This debate gives me new appreciation for what our friends in government have to go through.
Yeah, they get hammered from both sides.
I just want to throw that out.
Okay, my apologies. I may have had a miscommunication with one of our fellow Oregonians there on what we were supposed to be talking about today. But, we do want the public's input in general, so we'll sure hear about that topic again at another point. So do we have any more questions for the agency on this topic that are burning, or can we move into discussion of federal forest lands? Yes, well, I think the agency would like to come back up for a moment and make a few responses, and then our next speaker, the state forester, will already be there for the beginning of our next discussion. Another non-controversial subject, federal forest policy and harvest levels in the federal forest.
Thank you, Chair Clem, for letting us come back up to talk about this a little bit more. I thought since I was quoted, maybe I
that'd be nice.
make a few more comments about it.
For
the record, I'm Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry. I used to have hair before I got involved in public forestry issues, but what I don't want to really dispute, anything that's been said. I just kind of walk you through maybe the thought process that led me to think we're still trying to take the right path here. In 2003, when I came on board. It was an issue then. I had been working for industry at the time that I moved over here, and have been involved in buying and selling land for an industry. And so I kind of took those methodologies and applied them to the Elliott. And in fact, if you were, trying to move to a 40-45 year rotation, you could cut 60 to 70 million board feet a year, and that would be a pretty reasonable approach for industry. I think if somebody were willing to pay $1 billion for the Elliott, though, they would be assuming a lot more risk than what I would probably have recommended to, the board of directors or the folks I work for, because there's is in the neighborhood now. I think there at the time of the HCP, there was 27 owls on this 92,000 acres. There's 23 now. There has been, you know, lots of legal action around endangered species. There was an industrial ownership in Washington just recently that was enjoined from any harvest whatsoever on 40,000 acres because of one owl. And we're talking about 23 owls on you know, 90,000 acres. So there certainly is legal risk to, if not getting taken to jail, at least having your management activities tied up for a long time without any opportunity for revenue. There is an HCP on a piece of industrial land next to the Elliott as well. So, you know, obviously they interpreted some risk that they needed to try to mitigate there. And I think, you know, all in all, it still seems like if the state wants to continue to own the Elliott State Forest, and I think they do, because it does have other benefits beyond just income, then you try to find a place that manages those risks as effectively as you can. And at this point, it still seems like entering into an agreement with the federal government that would protect us from being liable for take would be a good thing. And if we could get that at a level of about 40 million board feet per year versus the traditional 50 million board feet per year that the Elliott was doing before the spotted owl issue came along, then, you know, that seems like it's not a perfect place. It's not 60 to 70 million board feet, but it's a place where I think we can adequately manage the risk. In terms of frustrated about how long it's taken and whether or not we're going to get there with the federal government, those are clear questions. There's no doubt about that, and Louise and I share frustration regularly about when we're going to get there and the fact that the federal government does not have the same perspective as we do. You know, they're not worried about dollars for the Common School Fund. They're worried about the Endangered Species Act. If for some reason that frustration gets to a point where we say, fine, we're going to give up on that, and, again, the state wants to continue to own the Elliott, then our only other option is to get out of the current HCP altogether, because that's just going to continue to constrain harvest and go to a real aggressive take avoidance kind of strategy that will have a lot of legal risk to it. We are currently operating under a negotiated settlement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about how we manage owls on our North Coast properties, the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forest, because in, I think, about 1999 to 2000, somewhere in there, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was ready to take the Department of Forestry to court for, you know, a contended violation, a contended take of endangered species. So the risk is there, and it would certainly be prominent if we went to pure take avoidance. And I think, you know, we would be challenged just up one side and down the other, because in addition to being a public agency, all of our information about owl sites and marble murrelet sites is public information. As you can tell by folks calling in, we get a lot of scrutiny from the public who are concerned about environmental values. So just in terms of overall managing risk, this seems to be the logical pursuit for as long as we can hope that the federal government will get there with us. If they don't, again, and we go to take avoidance, the strategy would have to be, as soon as a piece of spotted owl habitat or marble murrelet habitat is found to be unoccupied, and we can feel comfortable that we can legally defend that it's unoccupied, then we'd have to harvest it. We'd have to kind of systematically get rid of endangered species habitat as quickly as we could. That would be the alternative to managing risk, and it's kind of a perverse effect of the Endangered Species Act that it drives private landowners to that, but that's kind of what it does.
We have a question over here, but for State Forester. Representative Van Orma.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I just have a comment, because I think it's important to know that I have a community in my district, Cascade Locks, the Warm Springs Indian Reservation that have been waiting over 10 years for a decision out of the Bureau of Indian Affairs about a casino in the gorge. I think that we have a number of examples of how our business is impeded by the federal government in this state.
We're going to talk a lot about that for the next 45 minutes, actually. So why don't we try and wrap up on the Elliott, though, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you, Mr. Brown, in your experience, are there relationships between the federal government, I guess particularly, is it Interior? Department of Forestry is under Interior?
Forestry is under Agriculture, Representative Gilliam.
In other states, specifically on trust lands, where there is a better relationship or a different dynamic than the one that you're describing here with us in the Elliott?
Chair Clemon, Representative Gilliam, if you're asking, are other states more successful at negotiating with, say, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries, the state of Washington has pretty aggressively pursued HCPs with those entities on private lands and on their own land. This is my own opinion. It seems to me they gave up a lot to get agreement in those cases, and we're not willing to give up that much. You know, we did enter this negotiation saying the bottom line is we have to increase harvest. Because that's an expectation that's been very clearly expressed to us by the land board, by the legislature, and everyone else. We're not in this to give up more ability to harvest. And I, you know, just like I said, my own personal opinion, in order to get those HCPs in the state of Washington, they gave up quite a bit.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, pardon my ignorance on this, but is your relationship, particularly as it relates to endangered species, with the federal government different because of the Elliott status, or is it the same statewide in other forests? You know, you get what I'm saying. It's different for us because of the way we look at it and where the money's going. But is it different? Does the federal government see it that way?
Chair Clem and Representative Gilliam, I don't know that our relationship is different. I think the Elliott is substantially different than our other state forests, just in terms of the density of endangered species. It's so high there. We've debated and recommended and then decided against recommending going the HCP route on the Tillamook and the Clatsop State Forest. That actually still is a question before the Board of Forestry, but my recommendation to them has been to not go the HCP route up there. Because simply the endangered species density and existence just doesn't pose the same level of, you know, business risk that it does on the Elliott.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe we should just use the Endangered Species Act against the feds and somehow, in between marbled marlettes and coho salmon, put kids
and loggers. Another helpful comment from my friend.
Mr. Chair, I want to respond to the figures that were thrown out in terms of the value of the Elliott State Forest and had we sold it several years ago, what the Common School Fund might be valued at today. The Common School Fund is not valued at $1.1 billion anymore. It was early last year. As of December 31st, it is valued at just under $765 million. The 10-year return on investment is zero. So anybody who thinks that if we put a chunk of money in the Common School Fund 10 years ago from the sale of the Elliott or 15 years ago, that we would have a whole lot more money today, we would not. The Common School Fund is down significantly in the last 6 months, just as all of the funds managed by the Oregon Investment Council are, and as everybody's personal funds are as well. So we're all in this together, but I just think that's an important point. And while that return on investment is zero in terms of the financial portfolio, our real estate portfolio has continued to increase in value. And so, and I think that goes to a point that Representative Roblin made. I don't think we want to be selling all of our land base, because it is what allows us to continue to grow the value of the Common School Fund, which we see as both a financial portfolio and a real estate portfolio when the market is down. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you. I think, you know, my intention, obviously, as people have referenced, that the State Land Board has jurisdiction over this property. So my intention in holding this hearing, obviously, isn't to say that if we pass a bill saying go to take avoidance, or we pass a bill saying sell it, I don't believe that would be legally found to be implementable anyway. But I do think that it's worth it for our new members to sort of go through this, because I remember my first session last time, and I thought we'd have an HCP done already by now. You know, so we've all probably gone through that same experience. But clearly, our state land board has two new members out of three, and I do think there's some good suggestions about engaging with them in a constructive way, you know, about what the options are from the legislature. So that's why we're talking about. We're probably not done talking about the Elliott this session. The the jurisdiction question, you know, I don't know if there's alternative opinions out there about what the legislator's authority is. If there are, I'd like to hear them. Two, this question of the relationship of our constitutional mandate to the Endangered Species Act. Do they care at all what our constitutional purpose for the forest is? Can they factor that in? Is that anywhere in the federal law? I would guess not, which, you know, is back to that question. And then, and just third, I have a little to-do list of we need to invite congressional leaders in this state to help with getting this HCP approved if we continue going down this route. And we've got a new member of the House Agriculture Committee from the 5th District that I represent, who I would be happy to weigh in with. But we also have now, I understand, the head of the chief of staff of the Senate caucus last session is now on the Obama legislative team, and I still have a cell phone number. So I'm looking forward to trying to see if he'll answer on this topic and the Whopper. Representative Roe.
Yeah, I would say constitutionally the ONC lands, they took that issue to court. That's federal lands, whether they could manage them the way they have been managing them. And the Ninth Circuit, which is not the most conservative of our circuits, found in favor of this organization that took it to court, saying that it has to be harvested differently because it is by constitutional, by the provisions that set up the ONC lands, therefore the economic development of the area, and therefore they are going through this whole Whopper issue in large part because they have to do something different with those lands because the Supreme Court has said so. So I would expect that if these were constitutionally given to us by the federal government for the one purpose of producing money for the Elliott, I think that personally you could show that connection and say that the Constitution would say that these lands are a little different. And I think it's one of the reasons why, as they were saying with respect to Washington, we are saying we want more. We want to increase the yield with these HCPs. Because it is the particular reason is this is what it was set up for. So I think that allows us to have that conversation with the federal government as opposed to what Washington did with most of their private lands. So I do think that it's this.
Probably a good transition point into our federal forest policy conversation. Okay. So no members of the public signed up on this one, so we've got some time to talk about the advisory committee and other questions members have for you that you might be able to help us find answers to. Please maybe identify yourself again before we start this.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Again, I'm Marvin Brown. I'm the Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm here to talk about the work of the Federal Forest Advisory Committee and the final report that's been produced from them. You're getting a copy of that now. This started in October of 2004. The governor came to the Board of Forestry and asked them to take responsibility for crafting what he called a vision for the role of federal lands in Oregon. The board decided that a good way to go about that was to formulate an advisory committee, a very diverse advisory committee that could work through this issue for a period of time and then bring a recommendation back to the board. The members of that advisory committee are in the very first couple of pages of your report, and not going to go through every name, but what I want to point out to you is that it was an extremely diverse group of people. There was, members of the environmental community, there were industry CEOs and executives, there were county commissioners from the south, from the east side of the state and the west side of the state, there was a representative from the Board of Forestry, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, the Environmental Quality Commission. Mr. Cluding represented industry, or labor. So it was a really diverse group of folks, and significant there is the fact that in the end, that entire group agreed to this document by consensus. There was no disputing, no dissenting arguments about the recommendations and findings in this document. And I think that in and of itself is a really powerful statement, because this is a very diverse group. It includes people who regularly sue the Forest Service to stop vegetative management, and includes, like I said, CEO of industry and a wide range of folks. So they forwarded their recommendations to the Board of Forestry. The Board of Forestry was very enthusiastic to adopt them at their last meeting this month. And at this point, the findings have not been received by the governor. That should start taking place next week. So anything I say from this point on, I'd just point out that the governor hasn't formally accepted this yet. We're in the process of being able to brief him on it, and we'll find out what happens going forward after that. But I can run through kind of the basics in here. They did craft a vision. You'll find that on page 7. I think it's pretty eloquently said. I won't repeat it. After the vision, they crafted what they felt were 7 appropriate goals for federal lands in Oregon. They deal with environmental values, social values, economic values, plus 4 goals that deal more with the federal process and how that operates. Starting on page 9, then, they get into the findings that this group agreed to. Their findings included 3 what they felt like were problems of what they call place, 3 problems of place. And those 3 problems were, and again, this entire group agreed that there was a significant issue of declining forest health on federal lands in Oregon. This entire group agreed that reduced timber harvests on federal lands in Oregon were having a profound effect on rural communities. And this entire group agreed that there needed to be more certainty and more clarity around the issue of older forests and what percent of federal lands should be made up of older forests, because that seems to be the point of greatest contention when projects are disputed. So they had, those were their 3 overall arching findings about problems of place. Then they had 4 problems that really dealt with the federal system. They call them overarching problems. The first of those findings was that federal laws are conflicting, they're complicated, they're confusing, and they often lead to the conflict themselves that federal lands are kind of known for these days. The second finding was that if you look at the full range of stakeholders, from environmental interests to community interests to industry, there's not a lot of trust in those groups to sit down and work together and try to craft solutions. I think this group, again, exhibited a way to do that, a collaborative way to get together and work through the common issues and come to some agreement and gain some trust. There's no ability within the federal manager's set of rules and regulations to coordinate policies and decisions across multiple ownerships. And the fact that 57% of the forest land in Oregon is owned by the federal government means they have a profound influence on other landowners, and simply no way to coordinate their decisions with what that the impact can be to other landowners. And funding is a significant issue for the federal agencies. There's a pretty consistent pattern of disinvestment in these federal lands by the federal government over a good 10 years, and it's reflected in all manner of things, not just the lack of vegetative management, but the maintenance and improvement of their roads is seriously behind the curve. Campsites closed, trails not maintained, wildlife values really not, funded, and it just goes right down the line. The federal government, to put it in my terms, which I don't know are appropriate, is they've just almost walked away from these ownerships in terms of the level of investment they should be making in them, and they're not at this point. So from the findings, the problems.
Marvin, just yes. one clarification, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Just to be sure that I visualize what's going on, we're talking about multiple funding streams, multiple agencies, siloed agencies particularly, and then we're talking about congressional intervention and in a variety of agencies with a variety of instructions. Is that a clear picture of the mud?
Chair Clem and Representative Van Orman, that's a good description of the kind of the complexity and chaos that really, all of these layers of federal laws and involvements create at this point. Most of the statute. That might be mine.
I think it's mine. Sorry.
Most of the statutes are a product of the 60s or of the 70s, and they've been tweaked here and there. They usually, whenever there's new statute added on, like the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, it becomes another layer just added on top. There's nothing that goes away. So I think a lot of people would say, in a perfect world, it would be great to have a major overhaul of the whole system of policies and laws that guide federal lands, but it's a difficult thing to do.
Please continue, sorry.
Okay. So page 11 starts with the solutions that the group, this entire group agreed to. They were spoken out by solutions that could be addressed by us, by state and local government, and solutions that really needed to be addressed at the national level. The five solutions they proposed that the state could embrace. The first one was that the state really needs a permanently funded, adequately staffed federal liaison program. A group of folks within the state agencies who can concentrate on federal issues and really work with them to advance our interests. The second was the state should support collaborative processes. There are examples you can find scattered around Oregon right now where local collaborative groups have got together and hammered out agreement about vegetative management projects, and those agreements have been successfully implemented. It's slow, hard, tedious work, but it has been a way that some of these needed management efforts have been able to go forward without getting further litigated and hung up. And there was a lot of agreement that one of the things the state could do is really support more of these collaborative efforts around the state. Felt like the collaborative groups should focus on forest health issues and really be looking at landscape-level projects, 100,000-acre projects or more, actually sit down and develop 100,000-acre projects to improve the forest health on a piece of federal real estate. And it felt like these collaborative groups were the logical place to hammer out some of these issues around how much older forest needed to be left within the landscaped areas. And they felt like there needed to be a more formal structure for all of the state and federal agencies and the private landowners to coordinate, just to sit down on a regular basis and hash through common issues of boundary and ownership and things like that. At the national level, they identified three solutions. The first really is kind of getting at what you were talking about, Representative Van Orman, that there needed to be a fundamental effort to revise forest policy in the United States that dealt with all ownerships, that really embraced the notion that, that sustainable forests are important to the country and made that you know, a policy and a policy discussion on par with, say, the Farm Bill. You know, there's a Farm Bill that's passed every 10 years. There's no forest bill that, you know, is an expression of the fact that these resources are important to everybody and need, you know, that kind of policy discussion on a regular basis and involvement.
There is a little bit in the Farm Bill.
Yeah, there is a title in the Farm Bill. That's right, yeah. There's crumbs. Second was they're focused strictly on federal lands. There needs to be some legislation that allows restoration to move forward in a more expeditious manner. And third was certainly the issue of funding, both adequate funding and also solving this problem with fire funding, where when they get into spending a lot of money any given summer on fire, that money just robs all the other accounts. So that's a very quick rundown. It took about 2 years for the Federal Forest Advisory Committee to develop this. Like I said, I think it's an excellent document. I think it's centrist. It was agreed to by the whole group of interests. It's I think it's recommendations that we can grab a hold of. We have a number of groups that are really, really intensely interested in trying to implement what's in here. Oregon Solutions has indicated they could bring some contribution to the table to help facilitate the collaborative groups. Sustainable Northwest has said they would bring some contribution to help organize people at the local level to participate. The Nature Conservancy has offered that they could bring some technical services to the effort. What we need is an expression of the state's investment, the state's willingness to invest in implementing this. And I think we're poised that we could do some pretty good things. There's the economic stimulus package that's being discussed at the federal level, you know, is far from done at this point, but the drafts that I've seen represent some opportunities that we might be able to access some federal money if we had our act together and could go after it. So
let me ask a little bit about that. I know this is still being presented to the governor yet, so we've been fortunate to get an advanced look at it. Thank you for that. Do you know yet whether any of these recommendations, for example, this question of the liaison, you know, are should we be thinking about trying to get bills in before next Monday or whatever our deadline is on that topic? Do you know if the governor, you know, has his staff already preliminarily thinking about that? Are there placeholders in your agency concepts around doing something like that? Do we need that to do it, to do this recommendation? Do we need legislation?
It's for the state to be able to invest in implementing this is really a budget issue. We've got really good authority. Senate Bill 1072 was sponsored in the 2005 legislative session and was excellent direction for the state to get involved and how to get involved. And we really, I think we've framed up all the authority we need to you know, hit the ground running. But it's a budget issue, and it takes dollars to invest.
And I know not all or maybe not any POPs were accepted in any natural resources agencies. Was it a POP that was out there? Did it make it into, am I going to see it in my subcommittee as an option?
Not at this point, no.
What is POP?
Sorry, POP, Program Option Package, is Ways and Means term for, on top of their base budgets, additional options the legislature could invest in. And so they have to be approved to make it into, so they're not part of the governor's recommended budget when they're POPs, but they still have to be authorized to be brought to the legislature for consideration. But they're separate and above and beyond the governor's recommended budget for these agencies.
Okay, thank you.
Farm to School was originally a POP, actually, that did not get accepted, and then we went ahead and put it into a bill and did it anyway. So sometimes, you know, pops can still occur, even if they didn't make it to the legislature through the normal process. Other questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point here, Mr. Brown, on 18. Having obviously not read this,
page
18, word for word, was there more discussion or is there something else in the report that I'm missing on this whole subject of that first point there, last paragraph? In Oregon, federal forests could contribute more to domestic wood supply than the next phrase, wildfires emit significant amounts of greenhouse gases. How significant, and did you talk about that? Is there more detail on that?
Chair Clem and Representative Gilliam, it was discussed. It's being discussed still in places like the global warming, Oregon's Global Warming Commission, and it is an issue that would make a lot of sense to address. Wildfires, and in fact, I was reading some research early this morning, which sounds like a boring life, but in the fire-prone parts of Oregon, where a lot of this federal land resides, it's pretty predictable that those lands are going to be subject to fire, you know, within pretty short time frames. Now, it's different for the coastal forests and some of the west side forests, but in the east and the south, they're going to be exposed to fire in pretty short frequencies. And if there has not been any fuels treatment within those forests, and they're pretty heavily stocked, overstocked, frequently with bug kill kinds of timber, there's substantial carbon dioxide emission from those fires. Don't quote me on this, but I think one report that came before the Global Warming Commission indicated that in that one particular year, a fourth of all the carbon dioxide emissions in California came from wildfires.
Unbelievable.
And you can picture, you know, how many cars are in California. So it can be significant. And this research I was reading this morning actually said that if you thin those stands, they're more fire resilient. The fires do not burn as much carbon dioxide. Obviously, you've removed part of it, but you've also left a much more wider space stand of trees that aren't as prone for them to completely burn up as the dense trees. And so you end up with a net improvement in the carbon bank, if you will, if you can thin them and even at that, let fire run through them.
Quick follow-up, if you don't mind.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to mention was just, it's not totally topical, but the entire next meeting is devoted to the forestry fire program that the state of Oregon has, and so we can continue to have more conversations down this road during that, too. There'll be some same folks along with private industry involved on Thursday.
I'm heartened by that, Mr. Chair, and I'll save my harangue for that time.
All right. Representative Roebling.
Thank you. And, we have heard about the administrative costs in our forestry department and managing the Elliott and so on, and at the 30%. And I look at the BLM, and I look at the Forest Service, and I look at their 130%. So they actually have to get federal money sent to them to manage these forests is really disheartening. And we've talked about this. I really appreciate this document. I've talked to people at the federal government a couple times about talking to Oregon and seeing how they could maybe manage a little differently than what they're doing. And I hope that we can, as a united group, keep pushing this forward with our federal delegations and with others as we speak. So I thank you for this. And the fire issue, the one that really has frustrated the most, and this is in Representative Krieger's district, to balance their budget, what oftentimes is happening in these forest services is that they're selling off assets so that money can come in to balance their budget, kind of. And so our advanced fire areas, i.e. the stuff in Gold Beach, where we fought the last fire in the state in their forest, has now been pretty much sold, I think. Is that not right, Representative Krieger?
Yeah.
Did they finish selling it? So the place that, and hopefully we're still using it so we can be there, but the advanced
supplies and people and personnel are no longer in the position, from the federal government's perspective, to fight the fire that once we have had one, like we had in the Biscuit Fire, the history of the coastal range is that that's where the next fire will be in some period of time because it's ready. And so we'll get a lot of growth, and then there'll be another fire, and then there'll be another growth, and there'll be another fire, and then, I mean, they stay in the same places. And so I'm looking forward to the fire management deal, and I look forward to working with our federal partners to have a little bit better understanding of their impact on our state as well as a number of the western states. And that's the other thing that I think we have to realize is that most of the forests that the federal government owns happen to be in the west, and so they aren't of as much an interest to another half of the federal government back there, which don't have those forests.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Is Columbia Helicopter going to have a representative at our fire meeting?
Right now, unless they're members of OFIC, which I don't think they are, right? So okay. They not slated to, but we can let them know about it.
Okay. They have an interesting story to tell about that huge conflagration, how they could have put it out had there been communication between the local people and the federal government.
This goes back to this plan again.
Yeah.
And the focus of it is really originally designed to understand the state of Oregon's fire program, because you will be asked to vote on bills that expend monies and authority to the agency and how it's structured. And it's a somewhat complicated system in terms of when the private landowner pays, when the state pays, when our insurance company pays. So I want you all to understand it before those bills come. But we can get into some of these other topics too.
Then, if I may, yes. It fits in this context because we're talking about federal. In 2004, I was on the Ag and Natural Resources Interim Committee with Representative Smith as chair, and we were in Bend. And a gentleman from Columbia Helicopter talked about that huge millions of acres conflagration that started. And he had a chart showing us the growth by the day of that fire. And he had a helicopter right there when it was 100 acres. And he could have went out and put it out in a heartbeat. And there was no federal manager there. And Mr. Brown, I think I said this rant in front of you in 05. No manager there to say, go ahead and put it out. Well, and then on top of that, there was I got to throw this in there too, a poll done in Oregon, and 72% of Oregonians said salvage and replant that timber. And we didn't, and it's criminal that we didn't or couldn't. Thank you.
Okay, so we do have a member of the public who wants to testify. The only thing I want to do before we do that is just on page 17, note this one particular paragraph, a sense of urgency. I'm just going to read it into the record so it's out there. Forests are extremely important to Oregon. Of Oregon's 62 million acres, 30 million acres are forested. Of those acres, 60% are federal forest lands. East of the Cascade, 72% of Oregon's forest lands are federally owned. Yet despite their importance, large segments of Oregon's federal forests are becoming progressively unhealthy, and there's particular concern about the increasing risk of uncharacteristic wildfire, a situation exacerbated by climate change. Moreover, the infrastructure to address these problems is rapidly disappearing, particularly in eastern Oregon. What happens on these lands is of vital importance to Oregonians and the nation, and then in bold, it is also clear that time is not on our side. Unless decisive steps are taken soon, we risk accelerated loss of important habitat for animal and plant species, further degradation of air and water quality, loss of aquatic species, including native fish, and continued decline in community well-being, among other things. And again, this is a statement within a report by people ranging from the Nature Conservancy to the the Collins Company, and all agreeing on these things. So I'm very pleased to get this. I look forward to reading it in greater detail. This is a broad overview. We're going to have some comment next week on a specific piece of federal forest policy, the Western Oregon Plan Revision. We have Mike Carrier in from the governor's office to describe what their thoughts are on that plan and their current plans to appeal and describe the governor's logic on that for us, and we can ask questions. But thank you for your work on this. Yes.
Yeah, and Chair Klamer, if I could, I might just reserve a placeholder on your attention later in the session once we talk to the governor and kind of get a little clearer picture on where we want to go with this. It would be great for the legislature to be able to weigh in some fashion, I think. So
I think this committee would love to talk about it, as you can tell from the members' comments so far. Representative Earle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I think you'll have this information, but when you come back for the fire conversation, kind of the costs from our surrounding states for fires in, over the last few years, I think would be helpful in comparison to what we have spent. So the Washington, Montana, Idaho, California would be good information, I think.
And the state's contribution to those expenses?
Well, they only have state contributions.
So exactly.
They have no other. I assume that would just be the one answer. So.
Exactly. All right. Thank you, Marvin. Right. And then I'm going to call up Ivan Maluski.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, good to be here today. I'm Ivan Maluski, the conservation coordinator with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. I just wanted to make a couple comments here. We had the opportunity to testify in front of the Federal Forest Advisory Committee. I saw my name in the report there. And we'll love to make our comments to the committee available to y'all. I can do that after the fact so it can get in the record. I would have to say that we don't agree with, you know, every conclusion that was made, but would acknowledge that they grappled through a lot of very challenging and tough issues, the issues of older forest protection, the issues of roadless protection, the issue of what do you do with the fact that there are thousands of miles of roads crumbling into our salmon watersheds across, which is a major forest health issue out there, invasive species. They looked at a lot of these tough questions and tried to come up with a compromise document, and like a lot of compromise documents, you get a diverse group of folks giving up a lot just to agree on what was the final product. I will say this. One of our perspectives is that as we look at federal forest management and what needs to change, that we need to look beyond simply timber volume and what the timber side of the equation, that we have to look at the concept of economic diversification in some of our rural areas that are connected to our forests. I think that if you watch timber prices over the last decade skyrocket and then plummet to serious lows, you realize that there are inherent problems with trying to hitch school budgets, county budgets, solely to timber prices. And as someone mentioned earlier with the Elliott, you know, we could log more, but we may not necessarily get more money because of where the timber prices are currently. So on that note, I would say that there are incredible restoration needs in our national forests and our BLM lands that have to do with invasive species, that have to do with roads and culverts, that have to do with, you know, riparian damage, oftentimes damage from past logging practices that are no longer the norm of today. And there are opportunities out there to make investments in some of those, that holistic approach to forest restoration. And I just like to flag the federal stimulus package moving through Congress now has some significant resources for dealing with the road maintenance backlog in our national forests and BLM land. Something like $325 million is directed at BLM. $650 million to the Forest Service. If there are ways that this committee can identify ways to capture some of that, keep those resources in Oregon, I look at those are ways you can create jobs in the woods that sometimes involve the timber industry, but also help create new economic opportunities for heavy equipment operators who are replacing culverts, removing roads, and helping pull invasive species, et cetera. So I just wanted to flag that and as some some comments after the fact.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Robe.
Yeah, a comment on that. And I appreciate really what you're saying, because I also believe that we have real concerns with hunting access, hiking access, to roadless areas and others, and all of that has been laid at the foot of all these rural communities that used to depend on some of those things. And when you don't have healthy habitat, you don't have the game and the other kinds of things for both hunting and people who just want to go take pictures. So, you know, making these forests healthy is to every advantage. And clean water essentially comes from our forests and our federal forest lands. I think there's another person up here that doesn't think those are valuable assets that come to us, and we are losing those right now over and over again. And I think there are diverse opportunities for the economies of these rural areas around these places. And I think that that's what the conversation has to continue to be about. And I appreciate the fact that you recognize some of those and are willing to get to together with these other people to start having those conversations. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
Anything else to go to the order here? Okay. With that, I am going to adjourn our Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities.
One more access for 100 public land.